I have to say that sometimes when I prepare, I mean, I always enjoy preparing these talks, but sometimes I just come, you know, it's just such brilliant stuff that the Bible is saying. And this is, in particular, we're going to be looking at the book of Ecclesiastes today, but we'll come back to that in a second. Now, first of all, an apology. This was the poster we put up for the session tonight. It says, 42, is this the answer? And do you understand the question? And I said this was a slightly cryptic poster that you'd only understand probably if you're between the ages of 20 and 60, on the one hand, that's the first criteria, and secondly, male. And since I said that, I've had a stream of women coming up and saying, that's outrageous. And now, subsequently, people over 60 saying, that's ageist. Okay. So who could tell me what 42 is? Angela. Yes, it's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And a supercomputer called? Deep Thought. It set the challenge to find out the answer, life, the meaning, life, the universe and everything. And after something like 7.5 million years of processing, it comes up with the answer 42. And then famously, there's an objection. What? We've waited all this time and you're saying the answer's 42. You can't be serious. And Deep Thought says, no, I'm absolutely certain the answer is 42. I think the problem is that you don't understand the question. And I think that is a brilliant introduction to our topic today as we think about what is the point of life. So I want you just to think a little bit, about what would you say was the point or meaning of life? What is the purpose of life? You may think about the big picture of the whole universe and think, what is the purpose and meaning of the whole universe? Or you may think about what is the meaning or purpose of my life? And just whilst we're doing it, I'm going to play some music for your delectation. This is a bit of Pink Floyd. There's a bit of a theme to our music today. It's all rock. If you hate rock music, I'm really sorry. But this is your life for the next hour. It's an education, really. So we're going to listen to... So who could tell me who... Oh, it's Pink Floyd, but what song it was? Anyone know? Time, from the Dark Side of the Moon. And we're going to, I'm going to mention quite a little bit from that a bit later on in our evening tonight. We're going to be doing a number of things. We're going to listen to some more music. I'm going to talk for quite a bit. But also there's going to be a chance for you to respond with questions or comments both halfway through or just over halfway through and then at the end. We're here today to think about the meaning of life, the point of existence. It's a massive topic. I can't promise to do justice to it, but it's an important topic because unless we have an idea of what the purpose of life is, it's hard to come up with any sense of what the point of my life is. So I wonder what it is. When you are thinking about the meaning of life or your purpose of your life, what were you thinking of? Was it, for some people, it's recognition. What would give meaning to their life is other people recognise what they've achieved. For others, it's leisure. So actually, what gives meaning to my life is the pleasure of leisure, sort of going out and enjoying myself. Perhaps for other cultures and certainly other generations, it was descendants. It was the idea of passing on your seed, sort of having people, families to come after you. And the worst thing that could happen to you was that you had no descendants. And perhaps it's work. Perhaps it's work that gives us meaning. That if only we achieve in work, or if only we contribute to society through work. Maybe it's a sort of philosophy or a maxim of living. I want to give more than I've taken out of this world. Or alternatively, I want to take everything I can get. Or maybe it's through culture and the arts. Maybe that's where we get a sense of meaning. Or through beauty. Maybe it's by going to an art gallery or painting a picture. Really, I don't get any meaning out of my painting. I don't think anyone would. Or maybe it's a beautiful mountain scenery or a beautiful piece of music. And it gives us a sense of meaning, of purpose, of something about it. But by and large, in our culture, in our society and in our world, what we run away from is the possibility that there is no meaning to life, that there is no purpose, and there is no point. But what if it were true? How would you live if you realised that that were true? Well, we're going to look now at the book of Ecclesiastes, which, as I say, has blown my mind over the last few weeks. It's been the most intellectually challenging and stimulating book I've read, well, for many, many years. Let's start at the beginning. Who wrote it? Well, we don't really know, but it's written from the perspective of the teacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, which is almost certainly Solomon. Maybe he wrote it, more likely, I think, it was written about him. And if you want to follow Ecclesiastes, which you might find helpful, is page 670 in the Bibles on the tables. He was a king of famed wisdom and huge success. People came to him to get his wise thoughts. And he was a really deep thinker. And in particular, in the book of Ecclesiastes, he wants to explore his doubts. He doesn't run away from his doubts. He pursues his doubts in this book. And in particular, the doubt about whether God existed. He engages with the full possibility, in really quite courageous ways, that actually this universe is all that there is, and there is no God. This is the phrase which comes up again and again and again, under the sun. So he says here in verse 3 of chapter 1, what do people gain from all their labours of which they toil under the sun? And then later on in verse 9, he says there is nothing new under the sun. So here he is, he's imagining that what we see and can sense is all that there is. This universe is it. And he delves deeply into this possibility. If you like, it is, I was thinking of an image of this, it's like he is swimming and he takes great lungfuls of air and dives deep into the water, deep down into existence without God, exploring all of the farthest, darkest reaches. And every so often, his lungs burn because of lack of oxygen. So he swims to the surface again and takes a great lungful of air. He reminds himself and us, God does exist. There is purpose. And then having oxygenated again, he dives in again into the water. So to give you an idea, one of the longest dives is in chapters 1 and 2. And then he comes up for air briefly in chapter 2, verse 24, and then on to chapter 3, verse 14. And then he dives down again. If you want to understand Ecclesiastes, I do encourage you to read it at the end of this. That's what it, think of him coming up for air and then diving down again. It's as if, so that's what's going on. And I'm going to read Ecclesiastes 1:1-11 as our starting point. Again, that's page 670. And it says, the words of the teacher or the preacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. It's a great starting. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Before I carry on, that word there is a Hebrew word. It has a range of meanings. It's sort of the idea of so temporary as to be have no value. One example is actually it's a puff of vapor. So imagine we're on a cold day. And you saw me breathing out and you saw the breath come out as a, you know, whatever it is, condensation. And then in a moment it's gone. It's hardly there at all. You hardly notice it. Interesting enough, totally irrelevant this. That's a way to spot whether films have really been done in wintry conditions or whether they've just put little bits of paper on the floor. You look at their breath. Anyway, but that's what it's like. It's the word vapor, meaningless, pointless, nothing, nothing to it. It has no substance. Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Right now, he's not a good man to have at a party. And he goes on, he says, what do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. As all streams flow into the sea, yet the sea's never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. Interesting enough, That's like the water cycle. But anyway, very clever man. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. I didn't choose that Pink Floyd song accidentally. I don't know whether they knew Ecclesiastes, but listen to this stanza from the song. So you run and you run to catch up with the sun, but it's sinking, racing round to come up behind you again. This sun is the same in a relative way, but you're older, shorter of breath, and one day closer to death. That's the beginning of Ecclesiastes. So let's dive in with the preacher. It's going to take some courage, and I warn you, the water is going to get very dark before we come up for air. So what in the book of Ecclesiastes is the point of life under the sun? When you just say this is all that there is, what we can see and touch, what we can experiment on, what we can prove, if that's all there is, where is meaning? And the answer is, there is none. Because death destroys everything. Life, meaning, value, and purpose. Chapter 9, verse 10 sums this up. His logic is inescapable. He says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for in the realm of the dead where you are going, there is neither working, nor planning, nor knowledge, nor wisdom. Death is the black hole at the end of life. It pulls us inexorably towards itself. It's like swimming away from the Niagara Falls when you're at the top. You're going to lose. It robs us. It sucks all meaning and purpose out of our lives. If we look at chapter 9, verses 1 to 6, the preacher says, so I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands, but no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. All share a common destiny. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. Goes on, this is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes us all. It says, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. It says, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. It's tough hearing, isn't it? Why? So why, looking at that, why is death the thing which robs us of meaning under the sun? Remember, we're still part of his, what you call a philosophical experiment. He's imagining what it would be like if there is no God. Or do you think the idea of a philosophical experiment sounds about as appealing as a Weetabix and peanut butter sandwich? Try that when you get home. Well, I wouldn't actually. You might choke. But what is going on? Why does death destroy us of meaning? Well, first of all, because of death, everything will be forgotten. Those who have died will be forgotten by those who remembered them when those people too die. We saw that in verse 5. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. He started that in verse 11. Do you remember it in chapter 1? No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. And chapter 2, verses 16 to 17 says this. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So I hated life. All of it is meaningless. A chasing after the wind. It's quite hard to escape this, isn't it? Anything we might achieve will one day be forgotten. And remember, the preacher doesn't understand the full length of time of the universe. He's just thinking in terms of centuries and millennia. We can think in terms of millions of years. Will my life be noticed in a million years' time? No. I had this slightly strange interest, which is walking around gravestones, looking at them. It is an odd thing to do. I'm always struck by the inscriptions. They're always deeply moving. They're always trying to express some sort of deep love and deep grief, some better than others. There is one in Patterdale Church Hall in the Lake District, and rather unfortunately it has the name of this woman obviously loved, and it has born such a date and died such a date. And then it had nicely a quotation of the title of a hymn. So it had in their name, it has born such a date, died such and such a date. And then it had, now thank we all our God, which I thought was rather unfortunate. But it is quite moving to read these. But one of the ones I find most moving and most sad is a very common one, forever in our hearts. I wonder if you've read it. Maybe you've inscribed it on a gravestone. And it does speak of our deep love for that person and our wish that they would always be remembered and our commitment to always remember them. And yet it isn't true. Because they won't forever be in our hearts, because one day our hearts will stop. That's the tragedy of death. It robs us of meaning. And also, the writer says, it isn't just that death stands at the end. It's also there's nothing truly new. That was what that reading was, 1 to 11. One academic, a bloke called Christopher Booker, studied 40,000 novels and concluded that there are only 7 basic stories that all of those novels can be divided into. In other words, every book you read has already been written in another book. Or actually, one of the things about the cynicism of growing old. When you're young, you sort of think everything's new, don't you? And in particular, your parents don't know anything because you're discovering new things all the time. As you get older, you realise it's all happened before. It's all happened before. New technologies are simply the mechanisms for old stories. So Richard Dawkins concludes about the universe, it is neither good nor evil, neither kind nor cruel, but simply callous, indifferent to all suffering, lacking all purpose. So we're getting dark. Let's get a bit darker. Because then what we do under the sun is we search for meaning in things under the sun. So in things in the world, in the universe. And that's what the writer does, the preacher does. In chapter 2, the beginning of it, he thinks, well, maybe I will find meaning in pleasure. This has got nothing to say to our age, has it? We don't try to find meaning in pleasure in our society at all, do we? So he looks to creativity. He plants gardens. He's obviously a man of great works and great artistry. He looks to entertainment. We read that he goes to comedians to try and find meaning in laughter and happiness and just being made to laugh. I do read this. I'm not going to go through every reference, but you will find it there. He looks to consumption. He looks to cheer himself with wine. He looks that wine might cheer him. It may be that he becomes an alcoholic for a while, or it may simply be he becomes a connoisseur of wine. You know, he likes really expensive wines. He can afford them. We had a friend who once opened a £300 bottle of wine for us to taste. Totally wasted on us, since anything above £5 we think is amazing. But he looked for it in consumption, and he looked for it in sex. We get his mention of his harem, and Solomon had a harem of 1,000 women. In other words, he could look for a new sexual experience every night. He was the sort of dream of our age, perhaps. In fact, our age does something rather similar to him. We don't have sex with 1,000 people, but we can watch 1,000 people having sex at the press of a button. We look for meaning in pleasure. But the verdict of the preacher is it's meaningless. It becomes empty. There was never enough. Verse 8 of chapter 1, the eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear is full of seeing, hearing. You know that feeling, don't you? we think the first time we try a new pleasure, it is satisfying. And so we think, oh, next week I'll do it again. But it doesn't quite do it anymore, does it? And it's got a bit boring, and you need to up the ante or look for something new. And so we carry on looking, we carry on listening. And he didn't even have YouTube and Facebook and gaming, and he didn't have art. You know, we're constantly looking for the next YouTube clip that will make us laugh or make us move us or something like that. We're looking for the next Facebook post that will not make us feel rubbish about ourselves but make us feel good. We're looking for the next game that will distract us. We are a culture with so many new ways of entertaining ourselves, but we are more bored than we've ever been. Isn't that right? We're running from boredom and it's overtaking us. He also looks to work and toil. That's what much of the book is about. In particular, if only he earns enough, he will get recognition. Or if only he earns enough, he'll get a legacy. Or if only he earns enough, he can buy whatever he wants. But the verdict is death robs him of everything. We either toil away simply to give to another. Either our legacy is passed to another or our wealth is passed to another. Verse 19 of chapter 2 is very striking. And who knows whether that person who follows him will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. Maybe you can relate to this. Maybe there was some project you were involved in, and it was a real success you felt in your time. It really made a difference. And you passed it on, and either that person or the person afterwards destroyed it. And it's all gone. So much for legacy. Legacy dies. None of us leave a lasting legacy. At the end, death takes it all. Or we earn lots of money and we die and it's just passed to another person who may not be deserving and certainly hasn't worked for it. So he says even that work is meaningless. It is a chasing after the wind. It is vanity. And it also leads to the curse of dissatisfaction. When you look for meaning and purpose in pleasure and work, it is never enough. And it's one of the themes of Ecclesiastes. We toil under the sun. Our toil under the sun is tied up with dissatisfaction. Very interesting point here. Listen to this, verse, chapter 4, verse 4. See if it recognises anything here. It says this, "And I saw that all toil and all achievements spring from one person's envy of another." What's going on there? Well, he's saying, and I think he's right, that our efforts to get better and to work harder are either because we want more stuff than the next person, or we want what they have in terms of possessions, or we're competing with other people. Why? Because we want better reputation, better accolade than those around us. We work and we work and we work, driven by envy. In fact, it wasn't true for his culture. Our whole economic system is based on envy, isn't it? It is based on dissatisfaction. That's how capitalism works. That's how advertising now works. It makes us feel dissatisfied with what we have and wanting more. No company pays millions of pounds in advertising to tell you, do you know what, I think you've got enough. You've got everything you need to be happy and joyful. Don't buy our products. Nobody says that. And so we work to earn money to get what we do not have and we see other people have, even if they're imaginary people on advertising billboards or on YouTube or wherever. Coveting drives us. And here's the irony. We work so hard to get the money to feel alive that we never actually end up spending it. And when we do, we're so stressed by work, we don't enjoy it. Read chapter 4, verse 7 for that. I was talking to Neil Denley, and some time ago, he's working for a company, a sales company, and it was driven. People work so hard. And one lad there was working so hard, but he kept on going about, so, because I'm going on holiday to the Maldives. You know, he was working for this holiday. It sounded fantastic. The weekend he needed to go came up, and a big deal came in. And what did he do? He cancelled the holiday in order to secure the deal. What a muppet. What's he been working for all this time? Do you see how pointless it is? You're no longer capable of enjoying it. And in fact, he didn't even manage to secure the deal. So it really was very foolish. So Ecclesiastes, the preacher, tells us wealth is not linked to joy or happiness. Well, we know that, don't we? We know that. Nobody, I think, argues with that, whether you're a Christian or not. But we still live as if it might. We still were. Aren't we a weirdly, as the Americans would say, conflicted people? We work as if wealth would bring us joy and happiness, even though we know it won't. So it's the curse of dissatisfaction, and even wisdom fails us. I won't go into this in detail. But one of the points here is that the preacher's a big fan of wisdom. It's a light to our path, chapter 2, verse 13. But here he says, but wisdom under the sun is when we think wisdom will give us purpose. If we look to wisdom to give us purpose, it will fail. Partly, chapter 2, 12 to 15, because the wise person dies just like the foolish person. It says you could live a life of absolute wisdom, or you could live a life of total foolishness, but the same thing happens to both of you. You die. We don't. If you look at philosophy, actually, you see that a lot of the philosophers come to this point. They say death is a real problem for philosophy. It kind of destroys all meaning. And anyway, even if you didn't die at the end, which you do, you can never know everything. I remember teaching history. When you first learn a bit of new topic, you're really excited because you feel like you're really getting to grips with the topic, right? It's true for those of other subjects. But then when you try to go deeper into it, every time you learn something else, you simply become aware that there's 10 times more that you don't understand. I think maths is probably the worst subject for this, isn't it? I mean, what a nightmare. And actually, I remember when I was a student and doing chemistry A-level, GCSE chemistry, they told you, we're telling you this, but when it comes to A-level, you'll discover it's all wrong. And then you go to A-level and say, we're telling you this now, but you'll then go to university and discover it's all wrong. And apparently the same happens when you're an undergraduate and they talk about PhD. I mean, what a crazy world. I love, this is every student's perfect verse, their most heartfelt cry. Chapter 12, verse 12. If you're a student, everyone's looking now, they're going to write this one down. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Why? Because you will never know everything. You won't even get close to understanding everything. In chapter 1, verse 18, he makes a similar point, rather harder. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow, the more knowledge, the more grief. Aren't there times you wish you didn't know? You hadn't learned that? So even wisdom, if we look to it to give us meaning, purpose and significance, must fail. Now we've dived deep here, and I haven't even got to the heart of it, or the full depth of it. For most people, this truth about death is something which we get glimpses of, but then push to the back of our minds. The preacher pursues it. And perhaps we're feeling a little bit glum. Feels like this is a sign saying death and emptiness is all there is. But the preacher wants us to understand that what he's doing here is not a sign, but a signpost. He doesn't mean us to despair in suicidal helplessness, sitting in the sand at the foot of the sign. He doesn't mean us either to bury our heads in the sand and ignore the signpost. Or try to draw over the message with our own message so we feel better about ourselves. He wants us to see that the sign is actually a signpost. It is pointing somewhere. And that somewhere is when you come above the surface of the water again and you see that there is something over the sun. There is a creator. It provides meaning to our world precisely because he is not under the sun and he's not ruled by death. Now, in a moment I'm going to give you a chance to ask questions before we look at the hope that Ecclesiastes gives. Any questions or comments or something like that, we'll have about 5 minutes for that. But as you think about those questions, we're going to listen. There's another song playing in the background. If you just want to think about the question on your own, you can look at the song. If you don't want to talk to the person next to you, because I don't know why. Or if you just want to eat cake and you want to read the words, they're up there. If you just want to think or talk to the person next to you, that's also fine. This is a band called Thrice. I went to one of their concerts over August because I'm that sort of young man. And let's go on to what you were saying, what we're going to say next, which would be really good. And that is, we saw that God provides meaning. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 3, 9 to 11. Possibly one of the more famous bits of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes gets used a lot in weddings, which is very surprising, really, when I've just described what it's about. And this is one of those bits often used in funerals as well. This is just where the background to this is a famous passage used often in funerals. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot. And people find this very comforting. It isn't quite as comforting, perhaps, as it first appears. It does say a time to love and a time to hate, which is a curious line, a time to kill and a time to heal. But then it goes on to say, I think his real point here is, this is when he comes, breaks the surface and remembers God. He says, actually, whilst the world just thinks like it's going round and round and round repetitively, actually, there is a purpose behind every time, because there is a God who is sovereign over all. And that's what he goes on to say. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. So he says, actually, the very search for meaning is given to us by God to say that there is a meaning. And so we search for it. Our search for meaning is the eternity that God has put in our hearts. Our search for meaning is our signpost that we had earlier, saying, do you know what? There is something we're heading for. We are looking for something. And the crucial thing here is, we won't ever understand it all, but we do have enough to pull our hearts towards looking not just at what we can see under the sun, but to look beyond the sun. I don't mean in universe terms, I mean beyond the universe, because there is meaning there. As C.S. Lewis says, in fact, it's the search for joy. If I have a longing for joy that nothing in this world can satisfy, it must mean I was made for another world. And if you like, in theological terms or philosophical terms, what this means is we have an apprehension of God, but not a comprehension. No, don't worry if I switch you off of that. Apprehension means I know something about. Comprehension means I understand everything about. So our sense of need for purpose tells us that there is something out there beyond the universe, but at the same time recognizing we will never understand it fully. You know, some people say, some Christians, I think, unwisely say, when we're in heaven, then we'll understand. I don't think that's true at all, because I don't think our brains will be the size of God's when we get to heaven. We'll still be people who don't understand everything. It just won't matter anymore, because we know the one who does. And this leads, this perspective above the surface, beyond the universe, over the sun, leads to a different sort of wisdom, what I call supercharged wisdom. So let's read it in Ecclesiastes 12, 13 to 14. Now, he uses a phrase here, the fear of God. And I could talk for several years about the fear of God. For the moment, here's a little sort of shorthand. Fear of God in the Bible means the understanding that God is so much greater than us and understands so much more, and that we are so little compared to him that we'll never comprehend him. But we do know this: he made us and he loves us, and he wants us to be saved. So, bearing that in mind, this is what it says. Now, all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. A real thing in history, when you read any history textbook, go to the conclusion first. Find out what the point is. It saves you reading most of the book. Now, all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. There are three things that supercharged wisdom leads to. The first is humility. Humility before the one who knows all things. Ecclesiastes leads us to this truth. The true wisdom, if you want to be wise, is not about being clever enough. Wisdom is not when you know everything. That will never happen. But when your life is lived in tune with the one who does. That's what the theme of the fear of God means. It means living in tune with the one who knows everything. That's wise, isn't it? So if I want to sort of keep my car running. I don't learn all the mechanics of running a car. I keep my car being tuned by the person who does understand everything about a car. And so it is with life, which is beyond the understanding of any human being. I live my life tuned by the one who understands everything. So wisdom is no longer chasing meaning, but living quietly in the safety of knowing the one who knows all things. We can leave things in his hands. It doesn't mean that we become intellectually dry or lazy. Actually, precisely the opposite. For the first time in our lives, we have the hope that what we're learning is true and not just opinion. It also makes us, this humility, suspicious of the one who thinks they've worked everything out. Listen to this, chapter 8, verse 17. Then I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it. If anyone comes to you saying they've got all the answers, be immediately suspicious of them. We know this, that our difficulty, humility, is the right attitude. Because for all our cleverness, we can't avoid unintended consequences. We think we know how things work, then we do something and it doesn't work out. Have you noticed that? Let me give you a very recent example, Iraq and Syria. So Iraq, we intervene, we invade, and what happens is a car crash. Loads of people die and there's lots of suffering. We come to Syria. We've learned the lessons now of Iraq. We now know how international affairs works. We won't intervene. What happens? Terrible war, thousands upon thousands of deaths, as much as Iraq, and a huge refugee crisis. Do you know what? We just don't know what to do. We're not clever enough. What are we going to admit that? We're not clever enough. There is a proper humility. But the wonderful thing about knowing God is you say, but that doesn't matter, I can trust him. It's why actually we hold to God's word. Actually, being an evangelical, believing in the authority of Scripture is not arrogance, it's humility. It says, I don't have the answers. I don't believe that anyone has the answers. So I'm going to the one who does. And even when it doesn't make sense immediately, I'm going to trust it. Because I know that I don't know. I know you don't know. I know that the President of the United States doesn't know. I know the President of the United States won't know in the future. I know Stephen Hawking doesn't know. I know Richard Dawkins doesn't know. So I'm going to go to the one who does. It also leads to vindication. It's one of the big themes of here. We won't spend long on it. But the idea that one day, the fact that there is a God beyond the universe will make things right. And every evil will be punished. Of course we want God to do that, don't we? Maybe you've experienced the anxiety and misery caused by the sense of injustice in your life. It can be paralyzing. And here's the thing. If the person who hurt you dies never having been punished for it. It's horrible, isn't it? It's horrible. Are we happy that Stalin died of natural causes? Are we happy that... what's his name? Jimmy Savile died, never discovered. Does that make us happy? No, we want there to be justice. We don't want this universe to be everything, because then Jimmy Savile got away with it. But actually, when you know that there is a God over the universe, over the sun, we can know peace. The Bible has a much more wise approach. In Romans 12, it says this, when we find ourselves in that situation, when someone has hurt us, and maybe we are deeply, deeply hurt, it says this in Romans 12. It doesn't say just let them off. Just say it's all right. That isn't true. So it's very hard to hold a microphone and turn page, it just turns out. Romans 12, verses 19 to 20 says this. Do not take revenge, my dear friends. Why? Leave room for God's wrath. Know that he will deal with it, in other words. It is mine to avenge. I will repay. So we have transformed lives. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. Why? Because we know God will set it right. Matthew 10, verse 26, Jesus talks about those times when someone slanders us in secret, and maybe we never find out about it, or maybe everyone believes them and we never have a chance to counter it. Have you heard that? I was bullied. That was my life. People saying stuff about me that I didn't have a chance to counter. There'll come a day when Jesus says, you know, you heard that? It was a lie about David. He wasn't like that. It's good news, isn't it? What peace. And actually, that humility and that certainty of justice, that crying out for justice, in a sense, that's one of those signposts that points to justice. That song from Thrice talks about being in this closed room, but with a slatted window and peeking through a shaft of light and a song. Well, if you like, the need for justice and the search for purpose is those little bits of light shining through that tell us that there is something beyond the room. And so joy. It leads to joy. Do you know, people tend to think that Ecclesiastes is all about vanity and meaninglessness or death. Actually, the most common theme is joy and happiness. Very striking. If you read, it starts with one of the key refrains. There's like a chorus which they sing regularly. In chapter 2, verses 24 to 26, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? It says actually God's purpose for us in our lives is to enjoy our lives, to work and enjoy our work, to eat and enjoy our food, to drink and enjoy our drink. That's my Bible book. Isn't that a wonderful message? It says, if you're worried about life under the sun and you're worried about death, then look above the sun and realize that everything under the sun is his gift to you. So enjoy it. Enjoy it. Go home from here and enjoy your work. I too easily get trapped into getting anxious about my work or thinking I'm not achieving enough. And I felt really challenged this morning. Just enjoy it. Enjoy it. That's what the Lord is saying. Enjoy your work. How often do you thank God for the work you do, whether it's paid or not? How often do you say, thank you, because I really like this bit about my job. This is what I really like. It's what really gets me going. This is what I enjoy. Enjoy it. Food. Enjoy your food. When you eat the food, enjoy it. I love Toad in the Hole. It is a thing of joy to me. It lightens my life. Now, crucially, if I try to make work or food or pleasure the way I find my meaning, I'll destroy it. But if I find my meaning and purpose in God, then these things are released to be things I enjoy. Crucially, we find this joy in being thankful to him rather than the things themselves. We know this, don't we? If you buy something, if you go to the shop, you saved up, or you buy it on Amazon and it arrives, there's a great sense of excitement, isn't it? It's arrived. I've got it. It's brilliant. I'll go and play with it now. But it's much better when it's a birthday present, isn't it? Because it's not just a new thing you've been looking forward, but it's also a sign of someone's love for you and their care for you and their commitment to you. And so it is with the things of this world under the sun. If we just take them on their own, there's some pleasure, but that will fade. But if we take them as a gift, it tells us that there is a God who loves and cares for us. And so contentment is a result of this, and it's a key theme of Ecclesiastes. If you start at the beginning of Ecclesiastes, you have a harem. At the end, you have the blessings of a wife. Do you see that? The harem is about lack of contentment. I want another woman to have sex with to keep me going. The wife is, I am content with the wife I have. Chapter 6, verse 9, better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. So knowing that all that we have here is not just destroyed by death, it is a gift from God, is a wonderful message. It helped me through my father's death. When my dad died, it was horrible. And I still miss him terribly. It is comfort to know that he is with the Lord and that one day I'll see him. But there is another comfort which the Lord gave me when he died. And that was the reminder that I had had an amazing earthly father. But that amazing earthly father was actually a gift from an even more amazing Heavenly Father. And though my earthly father had gone, the one who gave him to me remained. And all that love and that goodness and that care that gave me my father remained with me in the one who gave him to me. It transforms life. I've got to say, one of my great joys is I've always known that God. So I have testimonies like my mum, like Dave, like others here, who actually went from not having Katie, from not having that, to having that. I think that must be brilliant to be in that position, to have discovered the joy that comes that knows that this universe and everything, that there is a Lord beyond it. And who is that Lord? Well, let's finish with this. Jesus. 1 Corinthians 1:24, it tells, don't look it up now, it says, Jesus is the wisdom of God. He was the one who came from beyond the sun, beyond the universe, to live under the sun, here with us, in order to defeat the death that held us captive. There may be any number of reasons why we might find comfort in the face of death, but this is the real one. He is the one who went into the black hole of death on Good Friday, who dived down to the very depths of lostness and meaningless and emptiness when he cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? When he lived in the midst of death where God was not present. Why did he dive so deep? So that in defeating death, he might take us by the hand and pull us to the surface where we would meet our loving Heavenly Father and discover hope and meaning and purpose. My offer to you would be the offer I give you every Sunday, which is take his hand. There'll be lots of other things offering you purpose, but none of them have defeated death. Some of them are well-meaning, some of them are just misleading. Take his hand. Because through him, our lives no longer end with death. And so what we now do has meaning beyond what the preacher knew. Everything we do when we put our trust in Jesus has an eternal impact beyond our death.